Okay, Ecclesiastes chapter 5. Ecclesiastes 5. Remember the theme of the book, just quickly. Ecclesiastes is a sermon by Solomon. Sermon by Solomon. Solomon's sermon. What basically this is, it's only 12 chapters. You can read this through in about 20 minutes, 25 minutes. It's not a long sermon. And what it is just a Solomon, basically a long description. Some have called this a divine fireside chat. Remember who Solomon is. He was given divine wisdom by God. He's one of the wisest men that ever lived. And what he has to say is more than just some old man's opinion. He's speaking by the Spirit of God. He's speaking with divine wisdom. You see, all through this book, Solomon said things like, I set my mind to seek out, or I had explored, or I turned and considered. And Solomon's basically, remember, Solomon was king of Israel at Israel's height. Solomon was the richest, most richest, most successful king Israel ever had. There was peace on all sides. Amazingly rich. The kingdom expanded under Solomon. The temple was built. Solomon's houses were built. He had it all. He saw it all. He had access to the best things the world had to offer. And he was given his divine wisdom. So Solomon, you recall also later in his life, fell terribly into sin with his many wives and the adultery of his wives. And God took the kingdom away from him and his two sons, all that. And apparently, this is Solomon writing towards the end of his life, looking back at it all, looking back at life as he's seen it. And Solomon has seen the heights and the depths of all these things, again, with divine insight and things. He sees things in ways most people never do. He sees the truth of things. And so we're really blessed to have this book. And Solomon is basically just like a fireside chat. He's just talking all through this book of a wide range of subjects. But one theme, remember, the whole theme is, this is what life is like if you live without God. And the whole book is based on, if you live without God, here's what life is, and here's why God is so important. And all through this book, he just goes from this subject to this subject to this subject. He calls it life under the sun. And of course, he uses the word meaningless and vanity and vexation and frustration. It's a long complaint, if you will, against materialism. Because think about it. That's very practical, because most people live like this. Most people live as if God's not there. Even many who call themselves Christians live as if God's not there. They live from day to day to day without thinking about Him, without considering Him. They go to work, they raise their families, they go to school, they buy and sell, all the things they do without ever thinking much at all about God. Sadly, many who call themselves Christians live like that. And Solomon says here, if that's your life, then he says that's what he's talking about. Under the sun, apart from God, here's all you have. It's not much. It's a sad thing he points out, and the things we all know, but he's actually commenting on Genesis 3. Remember how the world is a fallen world. It's a broken world. It's a cursed world. Death reigns. And everything here, no matter how good it is, brings with it also frustration and meaninglessness and pain. And we've seen already, won't take a lot of time here, the ultimate frustration he calls is death, obviously. He mentions in chapter 1 how the sun rises, the sun sets, one generation comes, one generation goes, and we just come and go. Again, take a time, walk through a cemetery sometime. Look at all the people who have come and gone. They've lived their lives, they've had their houses, they've had their careers, they've had all their stuff, and now they're just a name on the tombstone. They're gone. But life seems to go on. And it seems so meaningless. Apart from God, what's it all mean? It's all so meaningless and frustrating. And some guys work hard all their lives and struggle and toil. For what? Only to die and leave it all behind. And they're just gone. They're a picture and a photo album. He mentions in chapter 1 how wisdom, true godly wisdom, is a great thing, but it also brings pain. Because when your eyes are opened, when you come to see the Lord, and you come to see the world from the Lord's point of view and from a Christian point of view, you realize how messed up things really are. Chapter 2 had that long discussion. Solomon talked about the emptiness, the frustration, the meaninglessness of pleasure. And again, think about that. That sounds nice to say in a Bible study, but the whole world thinks the opposite. We're told today the meaning of life is to have fun and pleasure. Solomon said, I had it all. He did it all. Remember he said, I had houses and lands and food and drink and women and clothing and music and everything a person, that the finest the world could possibly give Solomon, said, I had it all. And he said, I'm telling you from a wisdom point of view, from God's point of view, it's really not worth all that much. Some have said there's two kinds of frustration. Those who don't have it but want it and are frustrated. Those that have it and are frustrated. Either way, you're frustrated. You work so hard to get it, then when you do get it, you find it just leaves you empty anyway. It's sad. There's a frustration of time. You saw in chapter 3 how There's a time to be born, there's a time to die, there's a time to laugh, there's a time to cry. All these things come and go. There's a time to have a great day, there's a time to have a terrible day. There's time for good news, time for bad news. Problem is, you don't know what time it is. And you can plan your day, you can say, today I want to have a good day, I'm going to plan this, I'm going to do it. You have no idea what's coming. And even to those who follow the Lord, those who live right, bad things happen. And that's frustrating. You just don't know what's coming. We'll see that quite a few times in this book. You'll say about how where there should be righteousness, there's wickedness. Where there should be justice, there's injustice. And he'll say later on in the book how the race is not to the swift. You can be the fastest runner out there, doesn't mean you're going to win. Nor to bow to the story. You can be the strongest warrior out there, doesn't mean you're going to win this fight. You could lose. That's just how this world is. He mentioned back in chapter 3 and 4 about injustice and greed. We saw last time about political power in verse chapter 4. And in chapter 5 we saw, when we got last time, about the foolishness of worship, how people worship God foolishly. They don't understand, realize that the reverence of God. They rush into His presence. Chapter 5 we saw last time, and he said, I sat in church and watched. People rush into God and just start blabbing off of their mouth, not realizing who it is they're talking to. That's frustrating. Here we are again. He's just going over this wide range of subjects all along, talking about here's life without God. Now here we'll see it again, chapter 5, starting in verse 8. So we talk about the frustration of money and possessions, and again he's going to get a powerful contrast here. This is neat stuff. You think about it. But ask this question. Think about it. Try to think of any human activity we do that doesn't involve money. What is there? Not much left, is there? It doesn't involve money. Either thinking about money, trying to get money, spending money, getting money, earning money, keeping money. Everything we do is based on money and getting money. Everything about us, everything we have is money. Money, money, money. There's almost nothing we do that isn't some way connected with either earning money, thinking about money, spending money, worrying about money. That's life. That's just where we are. I've tried to imagine what heaven must be like where there's no money. Can you imagine that society where there's no money? I can't even picture that, where there's just no money. But down here, it's all based on money. Not that money itself is not evil. Earning money is not evil. Working hard and getting a profit is not evil. But as we'll see here, as you well know, there's a lot connected with that. Think of how much time we spend, and I'm guilty of this, you are probably too, of just thinking about money. Your paycheck this week, and how many hours did I get in, and what bills are coming up, and how am I going to pay this, and do I have money to go out to eat, and there's church this Sunday, do I have money for this, and money for that. Think just how much thought comes into just thinking about money. You ever think about that? Quite a bit. Quite a bit. So here in this, starting in chapter verse 8 and following, he's going to discuss this, and he's going to start it with a negative down to verse 17, and then end with a positive note for those who get to understand. Let's just read now verse 8 and 9. He says, if you see oppression of the poor and denial of justice and righteousness in the province, do not be shocked at the sight. For one official watches over another official, and there are higher officials over them. After all, a king who cultivates a field is an advantage to that land. Verse 9 we'll deal with in a minute. That's a strange verse. But notice what he says in verse 8. This is what we talk about all the time. Notice it again. He says, if you see oppression, the poor are being oppressed. They're having their rights denied. They're having their stuff taken away. They're not having their proper due. The poor are being oppressed. He says, and denial of justice and righteousness. People aren't getting righteousness. The laws are being broken. Cruelty's happening. Denial of justice. He says, don't be shocked. And look around you. You see that all around you, don't you? All you hear about is oppression and corruption and people being taken, having their stuff taken away and their houses taken away and their rights taken away. No justice in court. He says, don't be shocked. It's everywhere. And notice what he says here. Why? For one, literally in the Hebrew, one high one, or one exalted one, watches over another exalted one, and there are higher ones over them. Here he's talking about money. Those high up watch over and protect other ones high up, and there's those even over there. You can transition to government. Not just our government, any government. Whenever people have power, whenever you give men money and prestige, it's almost inevitable, unless there's something guiding their heart from the Lord, that they're going to use that eventually in bad ways. So don't be surprised that you see oppression and unrighteousness and people being cheated and people being robbed to having their rights taken away. Because those at the top all look after each other, all take care of each other. Is that true? There's nothing new. Now, he said nothing under the sun. We get so mad today and hear about all these politicians passing laws and billions being spent to grease each other's pockets and pass laws that benefit each other while the average guy in the street, we're all left out of this deal. If you don't have money today, you're out of it. But that's nothing new. That was that way in Solomon's day. So if you see oppression and evil, don't be surprised, it says. Look how the system's set up. Those with all the money, those with all the power, take care of each other. Look after each other. I said that they watch over each other, protect each other. They pass laws in their favor and ignore those at the bottom. It's true, isn't it? And all he's saying there is that's what money does. The love of money, the lust for money, the lust for power. See?
So he's saying they have the same problem as we do.
Basically. Human nature hasn't changed any since Adam fell. It's the same thing. Now, he's not talking here about an American democracy. He's talking about back in our day when you had kings and rulers and lords and people who... back then you had no middle class. You had the lords and the rulers who had the money and basically the working class who had little money. But he's saying those in power really don't care about those underneath them. They all take care of themselves. They watch over each other and have each other's back. But the average person on the street, the guy that works for a living, we'll see here down in verse 12, he tends to get ignored. He tends to get his justice taken away and there's no righteousness for him. That's a sad thing. That's having your sheet there. It's a common byproduct of money. Oppression of the poor, denial of justice. The temptation to corruption is a natural part of riches. It is. God has blessed... Our founding fathers talked about this when they were first putting our nation together. Because back then, we were a small nation, 13 colonies, and it wasn't. There were some wealthy people here, but not like we are today. And they spoke about the fact that as God blesses our nation, that has become great and mighty and powerful, they were so concerned about how corruption sets in. Because it always does, right?
God warned the Jews that when they enter the land, they get money and wealth.
Exactly.
Land and
houses. Remember what he said? You'll forget me. When they were in the desert and they needed God, that was one thing. But God said, if you come into your land with milk and honey and you're sitting at your own well with your own house with your own family and prosperity, you're going to forget me. That's just our human nature. It is. It's sad. And whenever nations are blessed by God or some company is blessed by God or some person has great blessings, it's so common once you get rich. You ever wonder why you don't hear a lot of Christians winning the lottery? I don't know why. Maybe because they don't play the lottery much. But you look at some guy just won. I just heard some guy on a railroad won about $200 million or something. And you think, boy, wouldn't that be great? And ask yourself, would it? In one sense, it would be great. It'd be nice to have a lot of money. But could you handle that? Do you think you could handle that without forgetting him? Without all of a sudden changing your life into something it really shouldn't be? Don't you think so, Dave?
Yeah.
Why is that? Because of all that money. When you have all that money, where's your heart going to be? Where's your mind going to be? It's just inevitable. Solomon's saying here, when you see all these rich taken care of, don't hate them. Then don't be like this Wall Street, this Occupy Wall Street crowd that hate the rich, eat the rich. It's not wrong to be rich, but there's dangers in that. It just tends to corrupt you. It tends to lead you against God. Look at the verse 9. A lot of debate. Remember, I said Ecclesiastes. I don't know Hebrew much at all, but Ecclesiastes has some phrases in there that the commentators say we really aren't sure what this exactly means. But what verse 9 probably means, my version has it way wrong. It should be something like, after all, a king profits from cultivating the field. That's what it should read. Some of your versions say something like that. What he seems to be saying here is, all these men with money look after each other. They have each other's back. They care for each other, but they don't care what the poor. Even the king who never works. Kings don't work. Even he eats from the field. But whose field is it? The king eats. Remember when Israel asked for a king? Remember God told them, if I give you a king, understand what's going to happen. He's going to take the best of your sons, the best of your daughters, the best of your horses, the best of your lands. When the king eats, whose food is he eating? Did he grow that? No. I said that's wrong, but he's just talking about here about what he does. When you have power, you just tend to want to take from others and abuse others, look down on others, and justice tends to go out the window. And again, you see this so much in our own country in Washington, all these wealthy bureaucrats who just take and take and take and take, not thinking about who they're taking it from. Even the king, he says, eats, benefits from the field. But who's working those fields? Not the king. And they tend to forget what's happening here. It's a sad thing. The king, it just tends to lead towards, well, see that myth from New Testament, it tends to lead towards corruption and evil. You know, be careful. As Paul says, the love of money is the root of all sorts of evil. We'll see that in a minute. But I'll move on, having said that. The thought is we should not be surprised at corruption at the highest levels. Because power, as it says, absolute power corrupts absolute. That's why, again, our founding fathers in their genius separated the power. We don't have a king. We're going back to one. We don't have a king. No one man should have too much power, because no matter how good you think you are, when they give you power and money, it's just so hard not to become selfish, self-centered, self-serving. It just is. It really is. The natural byproduct of wealth is that. You know, our tax frustrations today are nothing new. They were struggling with this back in Solomon's day. He's talking about Solomon is probably off his throne at this point, looking back at the kingdom and looking at all the things going on. Isn't it sad? All the corruption, all this going on.
That's what caused the kingdom of Israel to split in two. When Rehoboam took the office after Solomon died, he started to put all the taxes on the people, and they revolted.
Yeah. Solomon had super high taxes, and they asked him, are you going to ease your father's burden? He said, no, I'm going to make it that much worse. And they revolted. They couldn't take it anymore. Sad. That's kind of what Solomon's commenting on, looking back at the kingdom and what happened to it, how things are, how the poor are being oppressed by the rich, and it's all through just love of money and this kind of thing. Even the king himself does that. But now, no, let's read on now. Let's go down to verses 10 and 12. Having said that, here's the principle involved. Verse 10. He who loves money will not be satisfied with money, nor he who loves abundance with its income. This too is vanity. When good things increase, those who consume them increase. So what is the advantage of those owners except to literally to watch? Verse 12, the sleep of the working man is pleasant, whether he eats little or much, but the full stomach of the rich man does not allow him to sleep. Here he makes this principle a contrast. Yes, there's corruption in high places. Yes, money tends to lead towards all kinds of evil. People with power and money just tend to forget those underneath them. They tend to forget the poor. It's a common thing. It's always been. It probably always will be until the Lord returns. But here he says, notice here he speaks of deception. Again, notice it again, verse 10. He who loves money. Now just stop. Let's be honest. Does anyone not love money? Wouldn't you like more money? I would. Wouldn't you like more money? And what do you go to work for? Because you love your boss? Because they pay you money. I was just talking to Dave Gray there. That's why they call it work. That's why I have to pay you to do it. Well, I like my job, but if they didn't pay me to do it, I wouldn't do it. Right? In some sense, we all love money, because money buys your food, puts gas in your car, pays for your house, pays for your clothes, pays for everything you do. In a sense, money is the fruit of your labors. There's a sense where we all love money somewhat. Just because this life you need it. It's just something that's actually what keeps you alive. Without money, we're in trouble in this culture. But also again, he who loves money will not be satisfied with money. Now think about it. If you love money, again, it's a common thing. It's just, we all have it. Because my little paycheck can buy this much. Just think if I had more, I could buy this much. And just think if I could double my paycheck. And just think if I could move up in my company and become a boss or get this big train job or whatever and double my, then I could have this much money and I could have, and once you start thinking like that, and that's true, and again, thank God in a country like this, you can still do that. If you really want to make money, there's ways to do it. Dean?
You call money your idol in that
place. Yeah, he says he who loves money. But if you get to the point, this is cool. I like having nice cars. I like having eating out at restaurants every night. I like having this bigger house. I like having spending money, a little jingle in your pocket. I got a few pennies in there. That's cool. And so you start thinking, well, if I had more, and that's just logical. If I had more, and of course the world always says, here's how you get more. And again, don't hear me as saying it's wrong to move up the ladder. It's not. If you can improve yourself, if you can work hard, if you need promotion at work or a better job, go for it. Nothing wrong with that. That's freedom. We should be trying to do our best. But if you love money, and notice what he says here, you'll never be satisfied. If you somehow think, if I just had double my income, man, I'd be happy. He says here, you're making a mistake. It's not true. If I just had his job, if I just had the money he makes, if I could just pay my bills and have this much left over, then I'd really be happy. That's foolishness, he says. And it is. It's an illusion. It's kind of like you see those cartoons where they dangle the carrot ahead of the donkey and it keeps going after it, but it can never reach it. It's that idea, if I just had a little more, if I just could have some more, they love money. And I'll say it again. He will not be satisfied with money, nor he who loves abundance with its income. What's the word abundance? Abundance means you have more than you need. Remember Luke chapter 12, the rich man who had all that stuff, he couldn't even, had no place to store it all, had to build bigger barns. He had an abundance. But he's telling us here, Solomon said, I've seen it. And of course, Solomon would know this more than anyone, because he was the richest man on earth when he was king. There was no one wealthier than he was. He could buy anything on earth he wanted. Can you imagine that thought? He could travel anywhere. He could have anything or anyone he wanted because he was the king of Israel, which at that time was one of the wealthiest nations on earth. And he says it again. You love money, it will never satisfy you. It'll never give you what it promises. It'll never give you what you think it's going to give you. If you love abundance, if I had more, just more of this. Notice the words there. You'll never be satisfied with this income. And he said, this too, he says, is vanity. Futility. Because Solomon said, I look around and what do I see? So I see everybody making this mistake. Everybody. Guys I work with, it's amazing how they struggle and fuss and fight to try to get a few more dollars out of the company. And he had this idea, if I could just have a better car or more overtime or more of this, and they're already spent to the max, and they're maxed out in all their bills and their credit is through the roof. If I could just have more somehow, they have this illusion. And they're chasing after this illusion. If I could just reach that point, that's why they all hate their bosses, because the bosses make more than they do. If I could just have his income, he's not worth that money. You hear it all the time at work. And he says here, it's an illusion. If you think that's going to bring satisfaction, you're fooling yourself. Now stop and think, because again, as I said in the beginning of this, almost everybody you know lives this way, don't they? Look at how many young married couples. They get married, they buy houses they can't afford, they're in debt over their heads, and now they're going to work two or three jobs for the rest of their living life. Why? Because they think, I've got to have a huge house, I've got to have this, I've got to have that. The kids come along, they've got to have the best of everything, and we've got to spend, I've seen it over and over and over again. Christians make this mistake, thinking that. I remember, I was raised dirt poor. My parents were living in poverty. And you can have the idea. I see some of my brothers saying to themselves, my family will never live like my parents brought us up. And they had this idea of big houses and big cars and money. And some of them have made it, some of them haven't. But he says, that's an illusion. It's just an illusion. It's a false, satanic illusion. It just doesn't happen. It's too, he says, it's vanity or futility. It's chasing after the wind. How well do you think most millionaires sleep at night? I wouldn't think so. Think of most of your politicians who are multimillionaires. Half of Congress are multi. Do you think they sleep well? You really think so? I don't think so. You think they can survive without drinking alcohol and all that stuff? That's why most of these guys drink so heavy. There's exceptions, of course. There certainly are. He says here, it's a waste of time. And now notice verse 11. When good things, and forget that, good things. He means houses. Houses are good things. Clothing, food, big family, nice land, property, trees. That's good things. That's the blessing of God. When good things increase, in other words, when you get this extra money and you're buying all these things and things and things, you're building your empire, says in verse 11, then those who consume them increase. Now, he's not talking here about an American democracy. He's talking about in their day when he had kings and he had lords and rich people. And the idea there is, the more you have, the more someone else is going to want it. Because as he says there, verse 11, the more those who consume them increase. When you became a lord or a rich person, you would build castles and you would have farms and lands and vineyards and groves. And you have all these people now living off your land, eating your food, working for you. And he's just saying there, the more you have, the more someone else wants it. Again, there's some debate here in the Hebrew, but when he says there in verse 11, what can their owners do except to literally look on? The word there means to watch or to guard. And think about it. I have in my driveway are two cars. Both of them are almost 11 years old. That's all right. But imagine if I had a Lamborghini parked in my driveway. You think I'd lock those doors at night? You think I'd leave a light on? Now I have to think about it, right? You know what a Lamborghini is, right? Or what are the big cars now? Lexus is, and I'll never know. You know, think about it, wouldn't you? He's saying here, now that you have all this stuff, now you've got to watch it, because now everybody else wants what you have. That's true, isn't it? It really is. You know, imagine if we start buying, you know, diamond-studded jewelry in the house and crystal $10,000 chandeliers and all that stuff. You can bet you're not going to sleep quite as good at night, are you? Someone has said that the poor don't need fear of the robber. They don't rob poor people. If you start having all this stuff now and all these materials, he says they're in all that stuff. And those are they're good things. But the rich worry about things you and I never even considered. You ever think about that? Imagine if you had several million dollars. You couldn't walk down Pottsville without a bodyguard. You couldn't send your kids to school without a bodyguard. You couldn't. You have a whole lot more worries now, don't you? Suppose you're driving around in a big Cadillac. Are you going to park on Center Street? I wouldn't think so. You'd be very careful where you park something like that. He's just basically saying that there's frustration with this. Those who have, they're good things, but when you get all these things, now all of a sudden you have to watch everything you have because someone else wants what you have. But now note the contrast, verse 12. Here's a proverb. The sleep of the working man is pleasant, whether he eats little or much. Most of you know what that means. You work hard, oh, I'm sure, John, you have some days you go home, you're that tired, you pass out in bed and you work hard. The sleep of the working man is sweet. Why? Because he's tired. He's worked hard all day. Maybe he didn't have much to eat, but he goes to bed tired and has a good night's sleep because he's a working man, because he's an honest day's work, honest day living. But notice the contrast. Verse 12. The full stomach, literally the word there is the excess or the satiety. In other words, he's stuffed. The full belly of the rich man won't allow him to sleep. He's dined on all this. You ever notice how the more expensive it gets, the more grocery, gets snails and caviar and all that junk. He's dined on the finest food there is. He's had wine. He's had a huge banquet every night. But he has all this money. He has everybody trying to get his money. He's watching someone else's back. They're watching his back. There's corruption is everywhere. How well do you think he sleeps? Again, Solomon saying, what's it worth? What do you think it's worth? The working man, he's not poor, but he's working. He's just the average guy in the street, has a job, works hard. He gets home and gets a good night's sleep. But that rich man, who you'd think has it made, with his full belly, he can't sleep. He's worried about that Lexus parked out in the driveway, and he's worried about his servant stealing his apples, and he's worried about that guy next door trying to steal his cattle, and he's worried about the stock market crashing, and what about this, and who's trying to rip me off here? And he's got 1,000 concerns on his mind because of all this money. The only way you ever runs a business, and again, don't ever hate businessmen. It's good that you can be a businessman, but you imagine the concerns a businessman must have to run a business. All your employees and all of the building and everything you have is your concern. I imagine most businessmen don't have a whole lot of life. They don't sleep all that well. That's what he's saying here. And Solomon says, I look around, I see everybody says racing and struggling, just thinking this delusion of, if I just had more, then it's an illusion. It's frustrating. When they get more, they're not happy. So they think they got to have more yet. I haven't reached that point yet. They got to have more and more and more. Again, in the sheet there, the point is that, you know, he who loves money will not be satisfied. You ask the question, why? Because money can't satisfy. It just can't. Solomon said, I had it all. Didn't satisfy me. Almost everybody would wish they could be in Solomon's shoes. And Solomon said, I was there. I'm telling you, it doesn't satisfy. The more you have, the more of those who want it. But put there in your sheet there, 1 Timothy. The New Testament's comment on this. In fact, he's actually looking back at these verses when he quotes this. Paul's talking to Timothy, the pastor. And this is a verse you all know. 1 Timothy 6 on your sheet there, start at verse 7. It's on your outline. We have brought nothing into the world, so we cannot take anything out. Just stop there. Look at verse 15 of your text. As he had come naked from his mother's womb, so will he go as he came. He can take nothing from the fruit of his labor, can carry nothing out. This is a quote right off Ecclesiastes. Paul's quoting Ecclesiastes to Timothy. But think that through. When you arrive in this planet, what did you bring with you? Besides a huge doctor bill. Nothing. That's obvious. You bring nothing with you except you. We brought nothing into this world. We cannot take anything out of it. And that just seems so obvious. We hear this like it's a proverb. It's quoted from Ecclesiastes, but think about it. Therefore, what does that mean? All this stuff you have, you didn't bring it with you. You're not taking it with you. Therefore, whose is it? It's not yours. You didn't bring it here, Mike.
Well, you said that President Obama has a lot of rich people worried in America.
Yeah.
Because he wants to redistribute that wealth.
And they're afraid they're going to lose their stuff. Have it taken off them. That's a real concern. Even godly people who have a lot of money are worried that he's going to come by and take it off them. That's a worry. If he didn't have it, are we worried about that? Well, some of the sense, but taxes. But the idea here is, you brought nothing into this world. And you're going to take nothing out. Therefore, all that you have, is none of it's yours. You didn't bring it, and you can't take it. And the point there is, as he's telling Timothy, like Solomon says here, then really, why should you get all hung up on it? It's not yours. The house Ryan and I are living in, we didn't build, someone else did. They're gone now. Someone else built that house. And on it goes. Let's read on. And if we have food and covering, with these we shall be content. Most folks don't believe that. But Paul says, long, if you just have enough to eat and clothe, he didn't even mention your housing. If you have enough just to bear to keep you alive, he says, be content with that. But those who want to get rich, does that sound familiar? Again, look at verse 10. He who loves money. But those who want to get rich fall into temptation. Notice, and a snare. That word there means a trap. That's what Solomon's saying. Paul here is just commenting on what Solomon said. It's a trap. It's a trick. The world says you've got to have, you've got to have, you've got to have. But that's an illusion. It's a trap. It's a bait and switch. Once you get what you think you're going to have, it's got you. They fall into a trap. And notice, and many foolish and harmful desires. That's the problem, even among Christians. It's those desires. Remember what Jesus said? You cannot love God and money. It's those desires. That's why, as Dean called it, a rich man can't enter the kingdom of heaven. Why? Because if you're not that there are no rich Christians, there are. But as much, now your mind has to be pulled off of God and onto all your money. And the danger is that's where your heart's going to go, where all your money is. Look at it again. Those who want to get rich fall into temptation and a snare and many foolish and harmful desires, notice, which plunge men into ruin and destruction. The word there plunge is the word shipwreck. Many, many people who had good intentions got snared by this, Paul says, got into the lust of more things, more money, only to find out that it took their heart off what was true and plunged them into destruction. That's serious. And here's the phrase we hear all the time misquoted. For the love of money is a root of all sorts of evil. How do they say it today? They always get it wrong.
Money is
the root of all evil. Money is not the root of all evil. The love of money. Money itself is not an evil thing. Anywhere you can say, steak knives are evil. They're not, unless you kill somebody with it. The knife isn't evil, it's what you do with it. The love of money. Again, notice your text there, verse 10, he who loves money. The love of money is a root, the source, he says. This is where it all comes from. Think this through. Of all sorts of evil. Isn't that true? Think of all the robberies. Think of all the people who get their houses broken into or get attacked on the streets. I go to Philadelphia a lot on the train. I'm always hearing the radio. Some mob attacked some lady and beat her up and stole her purse or attacked some guy or smashed somebody's window, pulled him out of the car, grabbed his wallet and ran. Why are they doing that? Money. Why are, look at drugs, people hooked on drugs. Why are they robbing our homes? Because they've got to have money. Drugs are expensive. People with these lifestyles, why do the rich cheat and steal and rob and lie? And why do they do that? To keep their money. They get more money. Money, he says, there is a root, the source of just this whole tree full of evil. And it is. And some, by longing for it, have wandered away from the faith and pierced themselves with many a pang. Get the word pang. You know what a pang is?
No.
You know what a birth pang is, right?
Yeah.
Strong, intense feeling. Those, he says, who long to be rich, who have set their sights on money, have now filled their hearts with all kinds of strong impulses. I must have. I must have. In other words, that is lust. I've got to have this, and it'll drive you crazy until you get it. But note how he ends. But flee from these things, you man of God. Stay away from this. Dean?
They say most marriages, when they end in divorce,
that's true.
It's fight over money.
I read that. Most marriages, these one of the main factors in the reason they break up is because they're fighting over money. And more often than not, what I'm reading is, it's because they think they've got to have a bigger house and they're both working two jobs and the kids and just the stress of trying to keep up with this, quote, American dream. And they're fighting all the time, and I've seen it. I've talked to couples that are in that situation. It's sad. And so he says here, all these things, it's a grievous evil. Notice verse 13 now and following. He'll conclude this bad section here in verse 13. There is a grievous evil. Get that phrase, not just evil. This is an awful evil. This is something to grieve over. This is a serious, wicked thing, Solomon says. There's a grievous evil which I have seen under the sun. Riches being hoarded by their owner to his hurt. Think of that one through. Solomon says, I've seen it, and I've seen it, and I've seen it, and it's so evil, it's grievous. And he says, you wring your hands wondering, why can't they see? Why must they all make this same mistake? Riches being, notice the word, they're hoarded to the point where you actually hurt yourself. What did Paul say to Timothy? They plunge themselves into ruin and destruction. When you love riches, when you hoard things for yourself, remember the guy in Luke 12? You hoard things for yourself. Now you're going to have all kinds of worries, all kinds of, as Paul says, pangs and lusts and fightings and all this stuff. Solomon said it's a grievous evil what the lust for money does. And again, be honest, think about it. Our country, our society, the Western world, pretty much praises this whole idea. They'll tell us the Bible's crazy. Lust for money is wonderful. You should always try to have more. And I hear all the time these commercials for banking and, you know, double your portfolio and look ahead. And not that it's wrong to plan. It's not. It's not even wrong to invest. But they always hold out this carrot. You can be rich in a few years. You can double your income. It's the whole idea. Look at it again there, verse 13. There's a grievous evil I've seen under the sun. Again, under the sun, apart from God. Riches being hoarded by their owner to his hurt. Now let's read verse 14. When those riches were lost through... Now, my version has a bad investment. This is one place where the answer really drops the ball. Literally in the Hebrew, is when those riches were lost through an evil task. It doesn't say what it was. This guy who was rich did something wicked with his money. Something stupid, something evil. Let's finish the verse. When those riches were lost through an evil task, and he had fathered a son, there was nothing in hand living for him. Here's this guy again who goes after money. He's lusting for money to his own hurt. He's got to have it. He gets money. He's rich. But he does something evil with it. Something stupid. Doesn't say what it's in. So maybe he's gambling. Maybe it's a bad investment. Maybe like a prodigal son, he wastes all his money on booze and women. Whatever he did, money, you know how they say, easy come, easy go? That's very true. This guy, whatever he did, through an evil task, through something stupid, something wicked, maybe he, like many do today, he bought three times the home he could afford, and all of a sudden now he's in debt over his head, and everything collapses, he goes bankrupt, now he has nothing. That's happening all over the world right now. People are buying and spending way over their means, and all of a sudden they find they had nothing, and of course their kids inherit nothing, because mom and dad just were so foolish. There could be something like that. It doesn't really tell us what it is. Just some evil task, whatever Solomon has in mind here. And it's gone. It's just lost. He had all this thing, but it's lost. He guarded his riches. He hoarded his riches. But now he's done something evil or stupid, and it comes so fast. It goes so fast.
Was it a really important thing back then to have an inheritance for your children?
It was. Sure it was. It was considered righteous that you could support your kids and their kids and their kids. You read so many times, like in Psalms, says how God blesses the righteous man as a blessing to his kids and his kids' kids. It was hope that you could pass on your land and your inheritance and whatever you had to your kids, and they'd pass it on to their kids. But here this guy gets something, he does something evil, something stupid, and loses it all. It's so easy to do. It's an evil task. Here's a classic example, again, of wrong priorities. Puts his money first and does it all wrong. Now notice how he ends here. Verse 16. This is also is a grievous evil. Exactly as a man is born, thus will he die. So what is the advantage to him who toils for the wind? Now again, he's talking here under the sun. He's not saying it's wrong to work hard. It's not wrong to be honest at work and do the best you can. If God promotes you, that's great. But he's pointing out all these dangers and all how money can come and go so quickly. It can't satisfy you. It's an illusion. It's a delusion. It's lying to you. He says, you can't take any of it with you. None of it's yours. Therefore, why are you wasting your life on something like this? Why are you giving something like that all of your affections? Think of it this way. Not all of you drive, but most of you will or do. You ever drive someone else's car? How do you feel about that car?
Nervous.
You show off, though? I mean, you go around your friends saying, man, look at my car. Look at Lam. It's someone else's car. You ever do that? I remember when I worked for the railroad years ago, the one engineer had this big Cadillac. And he asked me and a buddy if he'd drive it. He was taking a train from Hamburg to Port Clinton. Would you drive my Cadillac up and meet me there? And I'm 261 with a brand new Cadillac. That's not mine. Should I go around showing off? Hey, man, look at me. It's not mine. Why even get excited about it? It's not mine. That's the point here, isn't it? None of this is yours. You didn't bring it with you. You're not taking it with you. It's not really. You're just using it. You're just giving it for a short time. We'll see that in a minute here. It's not yours. It's a grievous evil, he says, because it's not yours. And he says, you can't take it with you. This is what Jesus said again in Luke 12. You get the idea, none of this stuff is yours. That's the whole idea of stewardship. I don't own it. We tend to do this thing. You judge each other by the house you live in, by the car you drive, by the clothes you wear. That really isn't a good indicator of anything, because they're not his anyway. That's God's gift to him. Think about it. So what is the advantage, he says in verse 16? What does that tell me about you? Not a whole lot. And then notice verse 17. Here's the sad part of this. The frustration of all this. Verse 17. Throughout his life, he also eats in darkness with great vexation, sickness, and anger. Now picture what he's saying here. Put the whole thing together starting in verse 8. Here's these guys who are looking after, they're rich, looking after each other in corruption, and they're watching each other's backs. They're oppressing the poor. They've got money, more money you can imagine. They've been chasing money all their lives. They're frustrated because they're still not satisfied. They're not happy. They have all this good stuff, but everybody else wants it, so they can't even sleep at night. They're worried about their stuff. Their mind's going a thousand directions. And all these things, and even some of these guys, because they do evil things, they lose their money, have nothing. And verse 17 tells us, what good is it? Because in their lives, and again, this is probably more true than we know, of those who are truly wealthy, darkness, great vexation, sickness, and anger. Okay? Yeah. I think I said this before. I read years ago in Dear Abby about some woman who won, I think it was in Ohio, in like some kind of big $7 million lottery. And she was saying how it ruined her life, because now they had to take their kids out of school, they had to go rent bodyguards, had to live in a palace, had to move completely out of the area because no one knew them, because everybody's begging for money and on the street. And it was terrible. They had to go into hiding, like in exile. People they knew back in kindergarten were coming by the house begging them to pay their house off. Please, you know. You had to go running and hiding. Notice that word. Throughout their life, he eats in darkness. There's great darkness in this stuff. Notice with great vexation. It's aggravating. It's irritating. There's no peace in their mind. And you've seen this. You know people who are always worried about money and worried about this and worried about that. And they bought maybe a big house and all they're thinking about is how they're going to pay this off and how they're going to do this. Or someone has a brand new shiny car. Don't you dare get a nick on my car. That's vexation. That's frustration. Next word, there's sickness. And literally, you worry yourself sick over it. Many do. Many, many do. And the last word, there's anger, fighting for us. Think of how, aren't most wars, in some sense, over money? Remember James says, why do you fight? Because you lust, cannot have, so you fight. Why are there wars among you? Because you want something, you can't get it, so you go to war for it. Whether personally or nationally. And Solomon says the whole thing is an illusion. It's a grievous evil. All this money does, like Paul said to Timothy, you man of God, stay free of all this stuff. Mike?
That reminds me of Princess Diana. She was rich and famous.
That's sad.
And the paparazzi pursued her everywhere she went and ended up on her death.
Yeah. And how many of those royals and this Prince Andrew and all these guys, would you really want to have their life? You think they're really inside them, fulfilled and happy and really knowing what life is all about? Their life's like a bubble. See?
The story of the king that wanted the vineyard, wasn't it just built?
Ahab, yeah.
He actually killed him.
Isn't that amazing? That's a good story, because Ahab is crying like a babe. He's a king of Israel. He's rich. He can have whatever he wants, but he can't get this one vineyard. What does he do? He goes home to his bedroom crying over this, and Jezebel says, "You're the king." And he murders a man over it and loses his kingdom over it. That might be one of those evils he's talking about here. He does something evil and loses everything. How often does that happen? More than we know. But now, let's look at the contrast here. Because Solomon, as he does all through this book, he gives us contrast. Let's read verse 18 at the end of the chapter. Here's what I have seen. Remember, Solomon's making here an experiment. I've checked this out. I've looked at this, Solomon says, from every angle. Verse 18, here's what I've seen. To be good and fitting. To eat, to drink, and enjoy oneself in all one's labor in which he toils under the sun during the few years of his life which God has given him. For this is his reward. Furthermore, as for every man to whom God has given riches and wealth, he's also empowered him to eat from them and to receive his reward and rejoice in his labor. This is the gift of God. For he will not often consider the years of his life, because God keeps him occupied with the gladness of his heart. Here's the other side of that coin. Here's the Old Testament version of what the New Testament is talking about all the time. Here's the proper attitude towards money. Here's the proper way of looking at this. Remember the contrast. The greedy rich man at the top, who stab each other in the back, who protect each other, who oppress the poor, who do all these backstory dealings, and they're never satisfied, they're never happy, they can't sleep, they walk in darkness, they're angry, they're worried over their stuff. Here's the contrast. Here's what I have seen, verse 18, to be noticed the phrase here, good and fitting. The word there literally means beautiful. Beautiful and proper. In Proverbs, several times he uses that phrase, he says, like gold apples in a setting of silver. It's good and proper. Something beautiful. Something that just fits. This is just right, he says. It's just right. Here's what I've seen, he said. To eat, to drink, to enjoy oneself. Notice verse 8, verse 19. Whom God has given riches and wealth. It's not wrong to have riches and wealth. It's not wrong to eat and drink. But notice how he's doing it. Again, verse 18. To eat, drink, to enjoy oneself in all one's labor which he toils under the sun during the few years of his life. Notice which God has given him. I have this broken down in your sheet there. He says, eat, drink, enjoy your labor, rejoice, gladness of heart. Note the contrast. Between the guy earlier who couldn't sleep, the guy who's worried all the time, the guy who's has to watch, have his back washed because someone's trying to stab him, because someone's trying to take all this stuff, the guy who compared to this guy who eats, who drinks with gladness, with joy, rejoicing in his heart. And notice, again, I have a sheet number 4, letter B there. Notice how many times this is said in these couple of verses. God has given him. You get that? His reward, literally his share. God has given him his portion. This comes from God and he knows it. Again, it says God has given him riches and wealth. It says God has empowered him to eat, to receive, to rejoice. This is the gift of God. 3 times in these 3 verses, this is God's gift, he says. And lastly, he says, God keeps him occupied with gladness of heart, so he's not worried about all this other stuff the world is. But notice how it all comes from God. Note the shift. You don't see God mentioned at all here in verses 8 through 17, do you? These rich men, these powerful, these fools who are chased after money, there's no mention of God here. But here's this guy who works, who labors. This guy's a job. But he knows that when I eat, when I drink, whatever wealth I have, whatever riches I have, it's God's gift. And therefore, I eat and I drink gladly, joyfully, happily, thankfully. That's the point. It's so simple, but very profound. Don't miss what he's saying here. Notice he says there, he says it again there in verse 18, during the few years of his life. You know that life here is fleeting. You know life here is like a vapor, Solomon says. You know, this guy knows, I brought nothing in, I take nothing out, but what I have, thank God for. And whatever he had, we don't know how rich this guy is, whatever he had, he's thanking God for eating and drinking. Look at chapter 2, verse 24. Solomon says this all the time in this book. This is the point. Dean asked me tonight, are we going to get to the good news yet? And all through the book he does that. Bad news, good news. Bad news, good news. Look at chapter 2, verse 24. We saw this already. After talking about how awful it is, and how your labors are in vain, and you're only going to die, leave it behind. Verse 24, there's nothing better for a man than to eat and drink and tell himself. Talk to yourself. Tell yourself that your labor is good. This also I have seen that it is from the hand of God, for who can eat and who can have enjoyment without him? Look at chapter 3, verse 12. I'll see this all through this book. I know that there is nothing better for them than to rejoice and do good in one's lifetime. Moreover, every man who eats and drinks sees good in his labor. It is the gift of God. Things aren't wrong. Wealth isn't wrong. Verse 19 here mentions that riches and wealth. As long as you remember, it's from God's hand I have these things. I didn't bring this here. I can't take it with me, but thank God I have it now. That's the whole point of this. That's what the attitude is. Thankfulness. Putting God and keeping God in this. Thankfulness then overcomes frustration. Most people you know who are lost, they're living lives of frustration and darkness and fear and worry. They can't sleep at night. The antidote is found in these verses. The man who knows God, who trusts God, the man who's thankful sleeps good at night. See?
The story of the talents. The man who does well with the money that the Lord gave him, he gets more.
And he gets rewarded. Yeah. And his master is well pleased with him. But he knows he was given these by the master. They're his. I've got to give these back. That's a good point. Very good point. Notice that there it says in verse... in the middle of verse 19, he has empowered him. Now get that. Because you read here back in the early part of this, verses 8 and following, these guys have all this wealth, all this money, but they're not able to enjoy it. It's misery to them. It's darkness. It's frustration. It's vexation. Why? Because they left God out of it. They don't even think about God. Remember that guy in Luke 12? He's worrying. What shall I do? What will I do? I have all this stuff. They're not in power. But this guy, because he remembers God, God blesses him. They can enjoy their stuff. Whether you have much or whether you have little, they're empowered by God. Again, it all comes from God. Thankfulness. Gladness. You know, he mentioned earlier about that guy who's a hard-working man. He may only have a little bit to eat, but he sleeps good. Well, that's what we're talking about here. It's a neat thought when you think about it. Many, sadly, cannot enjoy what they have. And I see so many, I work with these guys, you know, because the railroad is a pretty good job. These guys, a lot of they hire these I call them kids, they're 20, 21, 22, but they think because now they got a great job, they're out buying these huge houses, they're driving these $35,000 pickup trucks. I don't imagine they're sleeping well at night. Because they have huge mortgages and huge bills and all this stuff. They have all these wonderful things, but I don't think they're enjoying them much. Doesn't sound like it, at least a little way. I hear them talking. That's what he means here. This is his reward, his allotment. God has given these things. That's a beautiful thought when you think about it. Now, let's pull this all together. Again, here you see this contrast. Solomon's full of these contrasts. In the world without God, here's all you have, and it's not much. Even though it looks good, Hollywood makes it look good, Wall Street tells you this is the life, boy, you've got to have this. It really is an illusion. It really is. Things, no thing can ever satisfy your soul. It's not possible. Money can't, houses can't, fame can't. Solomon has been there. This greedy, power-hungry man, early in the chapter, he lives for money. He gets money. He gets power. What he finds is frustration, anger, fear, as Solomon calls it, darkness, sickness. This man here, starting in verse 18, who lives thankfully before God, it says, enjoys his life. He knows it's short. Life here is fleeting, but he enjoys it. He's thankful. He's happy. He knows the gladness of heart. Again, look at those words. Enjoy, rejoice, gladness. That only comes from when you walk with the Lord. Without the Lord, that's not possible. And of course, the point of the book, and something Christian needs to know, is this world is cursed. And you know that. You could lose everything tomorrow. You could lose your job. You could lose your home. You could lose your income. You could lose your health. It could all be swept away in a second. Therefore, what if you have your heart pinned on those things, then what do you really have? Nothing. You could lose it all. Don't expect much from this world. Riches and power are deceptive fantasies. You know, all the magazines have these big rock stars and sports stars and all these beautiful women. Like, oh, we could just be like them. You really wouldn't want to trade places with them if you know the Lord, believe me. You really wouldn't want to trade places. And as he says here in verse 18, it's good and beautiful. It's proper and fitting for us to remember that whatever you have, whether you have more or less, it all has been given you as a gift from God. Therefore, be thankful for it. Every meal you eat, you should bow your head and say, oh, Lord, thank you for this. Every time you put gas in your tank or whatever you do, Lord, thank you for giving me this. See? 2 Timothy 6:6-7. Godliness. Great gain. If you know God and you can be content, man, you've got great wealth. Here were guys with great wealth who had no contentment, didn't know God. What do they have? Good point. Some thoughts in closing, like I like to do. Letter A there. This world is driven by greed, envy, worry, and desire. Think about that sentence. That's universal. Do you know anybody who's not driven by those things besides those who know the Lord? Hollywood is. All we talk about in this election year is this economy. Not that it's wrong to talk about economy. The world is driven by greed, a desire for more. You need more. In some sense, the American dream has that illusion of more and more and more. Not that it's wrong to work hard and get ahead. It's not. But in there is that hook that, boy, if I just had that, boy, I'd have it made. And that's all wrong. Envy. You see others with these things. What the new iPhone 5's come out or something. Everybody's got to have one. Someone else has it, and I want it. I want one of those. That's a delusion. You think, boy, if I had that, boy, if I had what he has, if I had a car like him or that job or worry, that's that darkness he's talking about. You know how many people go to bed at night worried sick how they're going to pay their bill? Worried sick about when the phone rings, who's going to be on it? Worried sick about their job? Worried sick about whatever? You know how pandemic that is, sadly, even among those who claim to know Christ? And that word there, desire. Hollywood tells you in your face, you must. You're a loser if you don't dress like this and smell like this and drive this and have this. That's all a delusion. It's all a lie. Our society is based on the lust for pleasure and a desire for more, resulting in countless evils and hurt. That's what Paul says. Those who desire these things fall into a trap and misery and darkness and they shipwreck their souls. We are a consumer-driven society. Again, it's not wrong to have things. It's not wrong to buy things. But we're consumer-driven. We're the first generation in history to actually go shopping for something to do. Not wrong, but understand, we have this illusion laid out to us. Boy, if I could just... This is life, boy. This is life. Imagine if that was all taken away. Could you enjoy life? Like 3 billion people on this planet do every day? Could you enjoy life? Let her be there. Here's the question for us. This is why we're reading this. Is my attitude towards money and possessions biblical? Do you agree with Solomon here? Or is he a bit of a fanatic? Do you have a clear understanding of the value and purpose of these things? First of all, the value. You realize nothing you have is worth all that much? Because you're not going to keep it. It's not yours. You get a new car, and great, I've got a car. That's cool. You're not going to keep it. It's not yours. That'll be in a junkyard one day. Your house, someone else is going to live in. It's going to burn down, or who knows what's going to happen. Your clothes, your stuff, your things, your toys, they're the gift of God. Use them thankfully. Understand their true value. They're really not worth a whole lot, really. And their purpose. The purpose of things is not to satisfy your lusts. What is the purpose of things? Why does God give you things? Right?
To use it for His glory.
For His glory. What happens when someone gives you something? What do you say? Thank you. It's just natural. God gives us things. Why do you think Jesus says how God makes the rain shine, or the sun, listen to the rain shine, the sun shine on the just and the unjust? Why does He do that? The goodness of God leads to what? Repentance. God, you can tell the lost. You know, God's been very good to you. They don't know that, but tell them, God's been very good to you. Are your kids healthy? Are you working? Do you have food in your belly? Where do you think that came from? All these things are given to us, not to feed our lusts, not to make me powerful, not to make me have authority over someone else or to use them. All these things are given to us to say, oh, Lord, thank you. Oh, you are good. Thank you. Look how good he is. Look what he's given me. That's why we bow our heads when we meet. We're acknowledging it. This, thank you. That's a powerful testimony, isn't it?
The word empowered is what it means to me that he gave you the health.
Exactly.
The
health. Yeah. Joshua told the Israelites when they came into the land, don't forget God who gave you the power to earn wealth. Many don't have that power. Talk to somebody trying to find work, can't find a job. If you're earning income, if your bills are being paid, if you're putting food on your table somehow, you think that's because you're so wonderful? You pull that off? God has empowered you. Many don't have that. Many Christians don't have that. But it's a wonderful thing. Are you free from the bondage of the love of money? This is New Testament, this is Old Testament. Jesus taught this big time. Most of Jesus' parables had some aspect of how do you use your time, money, and things. That's true. Let us see. Think this one through. When you appear before God, what will you bring with you? You ever think that through? Are you going to take your house? No, but God's going to ask you, I gave you a home. How did you use that for me? Are you going to take your car or your furniture or your... No, that all gets left behind. But God's going to ask me, Rick, I gave you a car. Were you thankful? Did you use that for me? What did you do with it? How did you use that, as Mike said, to bring glory to me and to be a servant to others? I gave you food. I gave you a job. I gave you income. I gave you health. I gave you gifts and talents and abilities. What did you do? You don't take them with you. But what did you do with them? In a sense, you do take them with you. When you stand before God, everything you have here is left long behind. You'll never see it again. But what about all how we use them? And imagine, again, going back to these guys earlier in chapter 5, with all their wealth, they'll stand before God with none of it. And what do they have? Remember that guy in Luke 12 who says, so are those who are rich in this world stuff or who are not rich toward God. Think that one through. That's an important thing. We should always live with that day in view. When I stand before God, what am I going to have? And of course, last letter D. This is the point of this text. All that we have is given to us. Paul said that. Remember, the Corinthians were boasting over one another. I'm better than you, and I'm a better teacher than you, and I follow Paul, and I was baptized by Apollos, and you weren't. Remember, Paul says, what do any of you have that wasn't given to you? And if it was given to you, why are you boasting? Why do you think you're all that? Because it was given to you. You know, I've got a good job. Do you think that's because I'm a great person? It was given to me. We have a nice home. That's because I'm a wonderful person. It was given to me. All the things we have are given to us. It doesn't tell you how wonderful I am. It tells you how wonderful he is. When you see a millionaire, someone who's on cover of Time magazine, that's not telling you how wonderful he is. It's telling you how generous God is even to some wicked people. It's just the truth. And of course, the question is, do our attitudes reflect this fact? Like he says there about joy and rejoicing. Christians should be the most rejoicingest people, as I mean the word, happiest people on earth. We should not be walking around with dour faces and miserable all the time. We've been given some. We understand grace. We understand gifts. We have the same gifts given to us that our neighbor's given. But we understand where it came from. We are, just by the nature of the case, should be living a life of thankfulness and a life of humility. Not show-offs, but grateful. Lord, thank you. I don't deserve this. I couldn't bring this about. I didn't bring this with me. I can't take it along. It's not mine. I'm eating someone else's food. I'm living in someone else's house. I'm driving someone else's cars. They're given to me. The ability I have to earn a living, to earn a paycheck, has been granted me, because many aren't granted that. Therefore, I should be not proud of myself or trying to manipulate, or I shouldn't set my heart on these things, but on the one who gave me these things. That's a biblical attitude towards possessions and money. As Jesus would say, your life does not consist of the things you possess. Your life consists of the one who gave you those things. Where did you get them? Where did you get that? You know, when someone shows you their brand new $35,000 truck, they're going to be saying, "Praise God, look what He allowed me to buy." That's usually not what they're saying. That's what they should be saying. Any thoughts or comments? See how practical this is? See? This is not great Babylon which I have builded. And what did God do to him? That's interesting. That shows you what God thinks of that attitude. God hates that attitude. Because Nebuchadnezzar was a great king. But what should he have said? "Thank you, Lord, for being so generous to me and my people." I think what would have happened had he done that. Compared to what really did happen. Any thoughts on this? Powerful stuff, isn't it? And remember, most people you meet have this wrong. Especially here in America. Most people you meet have this idea of things I just got to have. If I could only have, somehow my life is lacking because I don't have quite enough. That's an illusion. It's a delusion, and it's wrong. Thankfulness, even if you have nothing, even if you lose what you have now, thankfulness is what's the only proper attitude for any one of us. See? Think about that. You couldn't do it. Couldn't part with him. He couldn't share. He couldn't give him to the poor. He would lose Christ for the sake of your riches. That man went to hell and left it all behind. And it even says Jesus was sad when he saw that because he loved him. That's sad. Mark says that. Anybody else? Let's close the prayer. Father, we thank you for your word. It is so applicable to our lives. It is so true, Lord. You know our hearts. You know how this world is, and Lord, our world today is no different than back in Solomon's day. But Father, I ask for us here tonight, for those of us who call upon your name, for those of us who know you and love you, Lord, free us from the love of money. Free us from the lust for things and for power, Lord. Free us from the delusion that any of these things bring happiness. Lord, only you are the source of our happiness. Only you are the source of our joy. Help us, Lord, to be free to the, we have little or much, that because we know you, we have more than enough. Thank you, Lord, for the way you empower us for the things we have, for our own houses and families and all the stuff we've got. Lord, we know that we have much. We are rich. But Lord, it's all because you have enriched us. You've given us things. You feed us every day. Every day, Lord, you cause your sun to shine upon our heads. Thank you, Lord. You are generous. But we know that this is given to us as a gift. We don't bring this about. We can't even hold on to it. Lord, help us to be thankful. Help us, Lord, to be grateful and glad. Get this right. And help us, Lord, to have pity on those who have it wrong, Lord. So many of those around us that we see on a daily basis, Lord, are struggling under these delusions, under this bondage. Help us, Lord, to remind them that God has been good to them as well, Lord. Just, Lord, teach us to think biblically, to think like Christians, to be free from these things in this culture that is so saturated with it. Again, thank you for your word and for how true it is and how wonderful it is. And we give you all the praise and glory in the name of Jesus Christ. Amen.